Hello and welcome to Your Health First. Have you ever been in doubt about some of your potential health issues? Have you ever been confused whether you should seek health attention or not? Fear not, QF Radio brings you Your Health First this season, where we'll be discussing health-related matters with experts from Weill Cornell Medicine. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Riaz Malik from Weill Cornell Medicine. Thank you for joining us here at QF Radio, and I'll let you start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm Professor of Medicine in Weill Cornell Medical College, Weill Cornell Medicine Qatar now. We've had a recent rebranding. And I do principally what's called clinical research in Cornell, but I also have a clinic that I do in HMC, in the Diabetes Centre. In terms of background, I'm trained, born in the UK, and moved to Qatar in June of last year.
Lovely. So tell us then a little bit, I mean, you're obviously working in diabetes and with diabetics here in Qatar. So we're probably best to start with a bit of an overview, really, to diabetes as a starting point for today's episode.
Yeah. So in terms of diabetes, the major problem in Qatar is type 2 diabetes. We do have young people with type 1 diabetes, but the predominant majority are type 2 diabetic patients. And unfortunately, Qatar has one of the highest prevalences of diabetes in the world. Not the highest, but it's up there in the top 10. And so therefore, it creates a huge problem in terms of the consequences of type 2 diabetes.
And I mean, you mentioned type 1 and type 2 there. Obviously, they have got variations. Briefly, between the two types, what are the differences?
So type 1 diabetes is predominantly diagnosed in children, adolescents. It is the cause isn't actually known, but we know that there is a immune process which damages, kills the beta cells in the pancreas, and therefore the beta cells, which would normally produce insulin, which is the key hormone, is not produced anymore, or very small amounts of it are produced, and as a result of that, blood sugars rise, and you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Whereas type 2 diabetes is, of course, as a consequence of predominantly changes in what we do in terms of diet and lifestyle, and predominantly driven by being overweight and not doing enough exercise and being what we call insulin resistance. That is, we've got plenty of insulin in the first phases, but actually it doesn't work as well because of the fact that we are overweight.
If somebody is diabetic, I mean, what does that really mean for day-to-day living and lifestyle? How does that work?
Yeah, so unless they have type 1 diabetes, is a very different problem, I think, because that is, you know, very, very dependent on taking insulin. And if the young person doesn't take insulin, then they will become ill and well very, very quickly, and to the point where, you know, they can be admitted to hospital with what's called diabetic ketoacidosis. But type 2 diabetes, it is, unfortunately, it used to be labeled as this mild diabetes, which means that really people don't suffer any overt symptoms as such. In extreme form, you know, people would say, well, you know, if you've got diabetes, you feel thirsty, you pass a lot of water, you feel tired, lethargic, you kind of get visual acuity problems. But really, the majority of patients don't get that when they have type 2 diabetes.
And I mean, we were saying before that with diabetes, it's not necessarily you can be diabetic and you don't necessarily particularly feel the influence of that, but it's when you have complications from diabetes that's where it starts to really impact on your life.
Absolutely. So the major consequences of diabetes are not the day-to-day living, actually. You know, of course, people don't like taking multiple tablets and maybe even insulin injections, but it's actually when they develop the long-term complications, and these are really predominantly what we call the macrovascular, which is in essence consequences stroke, heart attack or amputation, or the microvascular complications, which is essentially damage to the eye, which is retinopathy, which can cause blindness, and it's actually the commonest cause of blindness in working age adults in the world. Diabetic nephropathy, which is damage to the kidneys, which leads to end-stage kidney failure with requirement for dialysis or transplantation. And then diabetic neuropathy, which often is referred to as the Cinderella complication because people kind of forget about it. But that, as a consequence of diabetic neuropathy, you actually get pain in your feet, hot burning pain, which a lot of people put down to, you know, kind of arthritis, or they really can't give you a good explanation. But about one in five patients will actually have this very typical symptom, which is hot burning feet, they can't sleep at night. And then the other extreme of that is actually that they lose sensation in their feet to the point where they will develop ulcers, wounds, and they won't even be aware of them.
Wow.
And then once you develop the ulcers, then that's when you get the real problems. And it's at that stage, actually, that if you have diabetic neuropathy-related foot ulceration, then I choose my words carefully. It is actually a malignant condition. Mm. And I say malignant because malignancy, most people think about cancer, and they think, and as soon as you talk about cancer, people say, oh, it's terrible, somebody's got cancer, you know, they're not going to live very long. But if you actually look at how we measure outcomes in cancer, which is something called five-year mortality, i.e. once you're diagnosed with cancer, how long will you, you know, how many people will be alive after 5 years, then actually what you find is that if you have diabetic neuropathic ulceration, then your five-year mortality is 46%. Okay, now that is actually higher than prostate cancer, breast cancer, and Hodgkin's lymphoma combined together. And if you have a neuropathic ulcer and you've got poor circulation, which is an ischemic diabetic foot ulcer, then actually your five-year mortality is 66%. That is two out of three people will be dead within 5 years, and that is higher than colon cancer.
Quite startling statistics, though, and as you say, perhaps just not really recognised by people in general.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, I don't know what health care planners people kind of, you know, think about, but when they are planning, I guess maybe there are other priorities, but, you know, really stark figures like that I, you know, have kind of drawn me towards what I do in terms of a major remit in my research actually is to try and diagnose the problems as early as possible. And actually that is the kind of essence of medicine, which is, you know, if you can diagnose a problem early, then you can actually do something about it. But if you diagnose it when it's already kind of the horse has bolted, then, you know, it's too late.
Absolutely. Prevention is always better than cure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how are these categorized, and how can you people, you know, manage these complications?
So the best way to manage them is to recognize them as early as possible. So, for example, retinopathy, which is damage to the back of the eye, will, in, you know, up to 20% of patients, can lead to significant changes in their vision, and in about 5% blindness. But the key is to recognizing this condition early. And, you know, it actually starts maybe 20 years before people will go blind. And so, but what we do at the moment, our system is how shall I put it, needs to be addressed, because particularly in Qatar, we actually wait until the patient's vision is starting to drop. And by that time, actually, it's actually a little bit too late. And what we need is effective screening procedures. And by that, all it involves is, on an annual basis, what we call retinal digital fundus photography, which is a quick picture, takes 2 minutes literally to take of the back of the eye in all diabetic patients, and you can identify the disease early. And the best example I can give you actually is from the UK, which is the English Retinal Screening Program. About 10 years ago, they implemented what's called the National English Retinal Screening Program, which is every diabetic patient, if they unless they don't want to, will have an annual digital retinal photograph done. And we will identify early disease. And actually, for the first time, this has taken 10 years, but we are now seeing a significant drop in the number of patients who are registered blind. So that, you know, is well worth, you know, the investment. And for a country like Qatar, you know, it's no bigger than actually Salford or something, you know. You could easily implement something like that.
And so the procedure is purely like a screening, like you say, taking a photo effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's optometry driven. You don't even, and that's the other thing, you know, we have a very kind of secondary care driven process here, which is, and it's not good for, so eyes, immediately people think of ophthalmology. And I think ophthalmologists do a fantastic job, but they, you know, would be, use their, I guess, skills better to treat the patients they need to, not be flooded with unnecessary looking at, you know, backs of eyes of diabetic patients. So what you need is a system in place, which is, you know, where other places where it works, which is that diabetic patients will just go to the optometry and they will have a retinal photograph, and then the retinal photograph will be assessed, and if it's necessary, these patients will be referred on. So it's just having a logical system in place to screen for these complications. So for retinopathy, we have a model, but unfortunately at the moment we don't have one we don't have adequate retinal screening in Qatar. For nephropathy, it's actually easier because all we have to do is dip the urine to look for protein levels, and you can pick up early, very early damage. Neuropathy, we're actually still lacking behind because at the moment we don't have any screening at all. And again, you know, you're kind of waiting for these patients to develop an ulcer, and then it's too late.
Yes. So to try and catch them at that early stage. What would be your advice to perhaps somebody who is, I mean, we've mentioned some of the symptoms, and some of them can be really quite subtle with diabetes as well. So what would you recommend to people who perhaps are listening who've experienced some of these symptoms, and perhaps just a recap of the symptoms to look out for?
Yeah, so, you know, honestly, in terms of one of the key symptoms, which I think if you've got diabetes, and even if you have something called what's called pre-diabetes, impaired glucose tolerance, which a lot of people can have, if you have hot burning feet, you know, both feet, particularly at night, that is, to me, is a warning sign that there is something going on in your nerves that shouldn't be going on, and it is highly likely to be driven by diabetes. So it's an early warning sign to me. And, you know, there you don't need clever kind of equipment to kind of diagnose it. And, you know, if you go with that story to your primary care physician, say they should recognize that this is the start of a process which will eventually lead to major problems in terms of ulcers. Retinopathy, unfortunately, there isn't really anything early, because unfortunately, by the time if retinopathy is kind of how should I put it,
introduced
in this florid form, then actually vision starts to drop, but by that time it's too late. So using visual acuity drop is not a good way to screen for diabetic retinopathy, which is why, you know, in the UK and elsewhere, they've actually given up on, you know, using that as a measure. It's actually, you have to look for retinopathy. And then being aware, you know, other things like, for example, we've got a great, stroke kind of awareness program that's, you know, on the Qatar radio and, you know, all the time, which is great, because I think people need to be aware that this is a major problem and they need to be able to recognize it and get to, you know, the specialist centers like the stroke unit in HMC early, because honestly now but compared to my practice in Manchester in the UK, you know, it really, if you have a stroke in Doha today, the treatment that you get is better than many of the centres in the UK in terms of early imaging and interventions, which can actually make a real difference in stroke, which is, you know, reperfusion, which is, you know, getting rid of the clot.
Yeah.
And there's a great team of stroke physicians here that are doing a really good job.
We've got these first-class world medical, you know, team and staff working here in Qatar. So, you know, if you feel like you been with listening, thinking, oh, I recognise some of those symptoms, and just go have the checkup, go speak
and
to somebody.
If you turn up and it isn't, it's better than kind of sitting on it, and then unfortunately, if you go ahead and so in terms of stroke, you get what you call almost stuttering symptoms. So you might get something called a transient ischemic attack, a TIA, which is just a minor kind of you don't feel quite right, or your speech will just won't be right for just maybe minutes or maybe half an hour. Or you just won't feel right in one side of your body. But then if you ignore that, then unfortunately what happens is that because you're not treated adequately, you'll go on and have a major stroke, and then it's too late.
Mm. Prevention is always better than cure.
Yeah, and similarly, for cardiac disease, people ignore chest pains or often what we call epigastric, which is just in the kind of top part of the stomach, discomfort. They attribute it to heartburn. And it isn't. So it's just a question of, an increased awareness of people not to become paranoid, that every little symptom means that they're going to have a heart attack or a stroke, but an increased awareness.
No, absolutely. We try not to make everybody into a hypochondriac.
That's bad enough.
It's all about putting your health first, obviously. Thank you so much, Dr. Malik, for joining us on today's episode. Some really interesting topics. Is there anywhere particularly that you would direct people for information or advice?
I guess HMC has a website. I'm happy, honestly, being contacted via email. If anybody has real issues, I really don't mind.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you.
Any questions for today's expert, or you have any topics that you would like us to discuss in our future shows, please go online and like us on Facebook. You can post on our page and also, of course, follow all of the information about the programs here at QF Radio. You can also tweet us on Twitter at QF Radio 2. It's a Twitter handle that's at QF Radio with the number 2. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Laura Finity, and this has been an episode of Your Health First on QF Radio 91.7 FM.